was Helen Jewett? Who murdered her in 1836? She was a mystery woman with 5 different aliases and at least 6 different versions of her life story that went into circulation right after her death. A young man from a politically prominent family in Connecticut was arrested for the crime. He was charged with the murder, and then he was acquitted. There are a lot of unanswered questions here.
Historian Patricia Klein Cohen. She's here to talk about youth, murder, and sexuality in 19th century America. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. In the year 1836, a 23-year-old prostitute named Helen Jewett was found brutally murdered in New York City. Who was Helen Jewett? Who killed her? And how did her death become one of the first sensationalized murder mysteries in American history? Those questions are central to a new study of youth, murder, and sexuality in Jacksonian America. The author of this study is Patricia Klein Cohen of the University of California at Santa Barbara. According to Patricia Klein Cohen, Helen Jewett was a mystery woman. Early in her life, she was cloaked by respectability as a serving girl for one of the leading families in Augusta, Maine. But later, as a prostitute in New York City, she not only had several aliases, she also created competing versions of her life story. When Helen Jewett was killed, these differing stories took hold in the popular imagination because of the penny press and the growth of the reading public. Here's Patricia Klein Cohen.
It's a complicated story to unpack because at the moment of her death, the press leaped on the case and produced 3 different versions of who she was. And then within several weeks, somewhere between 3 and 6 pamphlets were also produced in New York City explaining her background. And so this trajectory from her respectable background in Maine to New York was under considerable cloud for quite a while. One of the tricks of my research has been to try to figure out exactly who she was, to sort through the welter of competing stories, rather different stories that explain her background.
Now, you say that in a way, Helen Jewett, or the person who came to be known as Helen Jewett, invented herself. What do you mean by that?
I think I can show in my book that the different versions of her life story that were put out by the press and then by these pamphlets after her death, many of them were versions that she herself told about herself to clients, to women friends, to people that she met in the course of her business. They were really inventive stories designed to position her as a more attractive prostitute. But what they created in the public imagination at the time was an enormous mystery about the mystery girl who was found dead. Who was she really? Did she deserve to die? Was she an evil woman or a good woman ruined?
Right. Now, you say, Pat Cohen, that in the literature surrounding this sensational murder trial in New York in the 19th century, that mainly the historians of journalism have looked at this case rather than historians of your ilk.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, my ilk is historians of women in America, people who study the history of women, and I'm interested in this case for what it says about questions of sexuality and life choices that young women could make for themselves in early antebellum America. The murder has been the subject of journalism histories almost exclusively because it was the case that inaugurated the genre of sensationalized press coverage of murders. Mm-hmm. It occurred at a moment in New York history when a penny press had just emerged.
Tell us very quickly, what is the penny press? How do you use that term?
It's a distinction from the 6-cent press of the time. There were many newspapers in New York in the 1830s, most of them commercial and political papers. But in the early 1830s, first 1, and then 2, and then 3, and then maybe up to 4, 5, or even as many as 10 small format, inexpensive, costing 1 penny, hence the name penny press, newspapers started to be published that appealed to a much wider reading public. A reading public much more interested in feature stories and sensational stories. And so the murder occurred precisely at a moment when 3 such papers were in full production, were competing with each other for news. And the take on this murder by historians in the past has been that this was a murder in a sense, created by the penny press.
Now, I'm going to present you with a very large order, Pat. The subject of, I suppose, academic conferences, the kind of thing that that you would do in a professional circumstance. What happens to a small but important word like truth when we speak of trying to figure out who killed this woman, who she was, and how the story got told?
Well, I think there are some fundamental elements of the story that have the word truth wrapped around them. Mm-hmm. One question is who she was. She wasn't all of these different people she presented herself to be. She did have a single identity, I think, and then these multiple identities that she invented. So my task as an historian has been to figure out what is the true story about her and where did she adopt these other identities and what purpose did she put them to. There is another question of fact in this case, namely who killed her. The man who was arrested for the crime, and he was a very young man, a 19-year-old Connecticut boy who was clerking in New York City in a mercantile establishment. He was accused of the crime. He went through a very lengthy trial. Very lengthy in his day meant a 6-day trial.
Goodness.
Where the judge inaugurated the courtroom at 10 in the morning, and they went until midnight or later every day for 5 or 6 days in a row.
Uh-huh.
And then he was acquitted at the end of the trial.
Now, let me stop you for a moment, Pat. Do you buy the acquittal? I mean,
read my book and find out.
I'm not
sure I'm prepared to say now. It is the fact of the acquittal in the face of such damning evidence. Of course, he did have evidence on the other side that led the jury to acquit him as well. Is one of the things that propelled this case to a larger fame, a lasting mm-hmm. fame. There was always a sense throughout the 19th century of a miscarriage of justice.
All right. Now, apart from the question of the man's name was Robinson, is that right?
Richard P. Robinson, son of a fairly prominent Connecticut politician.
Uh-huh. All right. Apart from the issue of his guilt or his innocence, what you do when you look at the murder of Helen Jewett is try to figure out the event itself and then the way it circulated in the popular imagination. Let's talk about that for a while.
Right. Because
we're back to the penny press.
Right. The media played this up in its multiple and conflicting versions. The pamphlets got into it, and then there was a set of engravings as well. There are a whole number of cultural productions that came into play mm-hmm. as printers who produced these cultural productions sensed a market out there that would be eager to buy these things. Now, some of the pamphlets were put out by people who knew Helen Jewett, who were trying to position her as a worthy victim. On the face of it, a girl who's a prostitute in New York City is the kind of victim who normally would not get a lot of play in today's papers. I mean, mm-hmm. The press makes value judgments about what kinds of cases are worth pursuing, and a case with a worthy, innocent sort of victim is one that gets a lot more attention. An interesting problem in the Jewett murder was how some of these cultural productions managed to position her as a worthy victim, worthy of sympathy, that would make the larger public care who did it.
Now, one of the things that you're doing in your book about the murder of Helen Jewett, Pat, is the language you use is that you're problematizing the issue of gender. And here I take it you are looking at the way young women, whether they were prostitutes or not, acted in a large urban setting, the kind of people that they would mingle with. You say that the accused killer was the son of a wealthy family from Connecticut.
Jewett was a young woman who came from a working-class family in Maine. Her father was a shoemaker. Her mother died when she was about 9 years old, and then she was placed as a servant in a fairly well-to-do family in Maine. So she has a not unusual background for a working-class girl. That is, she comes from straitened circumstances, and yet she's been placed in a family where she has the opportunity to learn, copy, and mimic the ways of the rich.
All right.
And from there, she strikes out to New York City and becomes a prostitute and puts some of her learning about how to mimic the upper classes to good effect.
Well, let me stop you. I mean, when you say that she's mimicking the upper classes, is there a hostility here? Is there a rebellion against the circumstances that, in effect, produced her and at the same time oppressed her as an individual human being?
No, I'm not sure I would say that. I think she was a very bright young woman, a very quick study. Her brightness was appreciated by the family that took her in as a servant, and they did a very unusual thing. They gave her an education, and they gave her free run of their library to mm-hmm. read books. And so she was able to, through the reading of books, I think, imagine herself into a different lifestyle, imagine herself adopting some of the mannerisms of the family she associated with.
Didn't you say that Helen Jewett itself is a name that she picked up in her reading?
Right. That was the, well, not that, she made it up from somewhere. I'm not sure where she got it. She went through at least five different aliases during her career, her short career as a prostitute. I should say her career began when she was 17 and ended when she was 22. And in that space of time, she developed five different aliases and different versions of her background story.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about when we speak of problematizing gender in the 19th century, what about the background of the accused killer, the man named Robinson? Why is that noteworthy for a person of his background to come to New York City and end up being accused of this awful crime?
Well, his background is not particularly noteworthy. I mean, he's a young man doing what thousands and thousands of other young men were doing in the 1830s, leaving farms, leaving rural and small-town families and heading for the big metropolis of either Boston or Portland, Maine, or New York or Philadelphia, taking up apprenticeships, essentially, in the mercantile world. So what he is doing is utterly routine and ordinary, but what the country was unprepared for was the effect of thousands of young men on the loose, cut loose from the moorings of family control.
And leading, you say, double lives when they get into these urban circumstances.
Right. 20 years before the 1830s, such young men who learned mercantile careers would have lodged with the merchant they were studying with. They would have been under familial control somewhere, somehow. If not their own father, then their master would impose some control on them. But what's happening in New York in the 1830s is a population is expanding, exploding very rapidly. Merchants are moving away from the downtown and no longer keeping clerks with them under the same roof. The young men are living in boarding houses. They are on their own. They work long days from early in the morning until sunset at night, but they have their evenings to themselves, and large numbers of them start getting in trouble.
Now let's go back to the narrative itself of the murder of Helen Jewett, the arrest of the man that, his name again is Richard Robinson, and the trial. Tell me about the trial and the press coverage. This really captured the popular imagination.
There was something about this crime that resonated with problems that people are thinking about in the 1830s. One is the problem of unsupervised youth, and I illustrated that with reference to the male youths, but actually girls too in very large numbers are flocking to the big cities for work, not just work as prostitutes like Jewett was, but coming to the city to be domestic servants for the most part, or to work in millinery establishments and seamstressing jobs and so on. So there is something about this case that really touches to the heart of problems that people consider difficult to solve at the time, the rising numbers of unsupervised youth, the rising numbers of prostitutes in the big city. The trial, the publicity leading up to the trial, and then the trial itself generated enormous interest on the part of the reading public. This was one of the first trials where lots of reporters came and wrote down everything verbatim. 20 different reporters from newspapers all over the country came and created transcripts of the trial.
And just parenthetically, how consistent are all of those accounts?
They're really quite consistent, and I use them comparing one to the next to amplify the data. Some guy will get part of the testimony down, and someone else will have a bit more detail about it. And so it's an interesting task for me as the historian to compare these different recorded renditions of what went on in the courtroom.
Now, you said earlier that we need to read the book to figure out whether this guy did it or not, but I want to press you on that.
Okay.
How do you make that kind of call when 160 years later, you're visiting these circumstances and trying to tell the truth with a capital T as a professional historian?
It's possible that I won't ever know the truth. I mean, we know that from trials today. When we finish with a trial, do we really know what happened? 12 people have gone off into a room and debated among themselves about what's happened, and that's what happened in this case, too. There was a jury of 12 men who came back in 15 minutes, actually, I should say, with an acquittal of the accused. But people at the time didn't know whether he had done it, and I don't think I can produce any compelling evidence.
What about, didn't you say that there were some revealing and shocking jailhouse letters that somehow shed some light on guilt or innocence here?
Yes, there were. There are a number of very interesting letters in this case, and the ones you're referring to are some letters that Robinson passed to a friend of his who was in jail on another charge in the month before he came to trial. These letters came to light, found in the pockets or else intercepted. Some of them were intercepted by the person who passed them between the two young men, and they were published in New York newspapers a month after the trial. They, in fact, don't bear on the trial at all. They have nothing to do with the actual circumstances of the murder and of the relationship this man had with Helen Jewett. But what they did show was that the identity that Robinson's attorney had created for him of the 19-year-old innocent boy, the sweet, shy, charming, innocent boy. His lawyer kept saying, this innocent boy, how could he do it? These letters showed conclusively that he was no innocent boy. They were letters that bragged about his low-life time in New York, bragged about the 20 different women he'd seduced, really portrayed him to be basically a scoundrel and a rat.
Is there any...
You can't convict a person just because they're a scoundrel and a rat. Though.
Exactly. I mean, you have to deal with evidence, and here again, we're coming back to what you're doing as a historian. Is there any, to use that word, evidence, Pat Cohen, that that Helen Jewett's murder stemmed from, what, seduction and betrayal, you know, these sort of classic, large, sensational terms that we think about in not early, but 19th century American literature?
Well, Americans in the 1830s thought in those terms exactly, and one of the things I want to argue in this book is the reception of the Jewett story at the time was framed largely in the context of very familiar fiction narratives about seduction and betrayal. The way to position a prostitute as a worthy victim is to show her as an unwitting, innocent victim of evil, licentious male behavior. And that's what her friends tried to position her as. So there is a way in which this case is drawing on very familiar themes. At the same time, it's creating and consolidating new themes as well.
Now, are you arguing by contrast with that line of reasoning that Helen Jewett was not the the unwilling victim, that she was very sophisticated, she knew what she was doing as a prostitute? You say that she was the beneficiary of an education. That was unusual for her time. What about this? Was she a schemer?
I'm not sure what you mean by schemer, but I see her as a very assertive young woman who carefully calculated the best way up in life for her. And she constructed a fairly interesting and unrestrained and financially remunerative life for herself. Mm-hmm. I think she cleverly manipulated the narratives, the fictional narratives of the sympathy for the seduced woman, in order to create client interest in herself. But she is, I think, consciously manipulating the categories, the cultural categories of her time.
We are talking, Pat Cohen, about your forthcoming book about the notorious 1836 murder of a woman named Helen Jewett in Jacksonian America. You characterize yourself as a historian of women and women's issues. Is this a book about feminism? What sort of ideological baggage do you bring to the writing of this book when we speak of interpreting all of these difficult facts that are back there?
My focus is on Jewett herself. You could write a book that would focus on the press. You could write a book that would focus on the trial. You could write a book that might focus on murder as a cultural construction in American life. And I have chosen to take Jewett as my focus because I'm very interested in how the society at large shapes women's options in life, and then given an array of options, what a clever young woman can do to maximize her opportunities in life. I'm trying to be very, very careful not to romanticize prostitution, which is a big pitfall I could fall into here. But I think if you look at the different options that someone like Jewett had, it's hard not to say that prostitution was a reasonable choice among many that she could have made. And so to the extent that my book focuses on questions of women's independence and autonomy and positions her as a woman who is an autonomous young woman making choices about her life, then I think that you could say that my background as a scholar of feminist history and the history of women, it shows up there.
Well, what then can we say, Pat Cohen, about the popular assumptions that get made when we speak of this very sensational relationship between sexuality and murder? You are challenging those assumptions, are you not?
I'm trying to problematize them. I'm trying to say that they're not natural. All the historians who've talked about this case in terms of the history of journalism have assumed that when a murder comes along that involves sex in any way, and this one did because she was a prostitute in a brothel, it will automatically be a subject of popular interest. And what I would like to argue in this book is that in the 1830s, those categories of sensationalism around erotic violence are just in a formative stage. 20, 30, 40 years before this case occurred, I don't think newspapers would have played it up this way. I don't think people would have seen the same connections in it that we do now. It's something that we take utterly for granted now. We take it for granted as entertainment. We have whole television and movie industries and cheap novel industries founded on the notion that sex and violence sell and can be made to be interesting and entertaining to people. This is a case where those formulas are just beginning to be established.
What you are saying, Pat, after a fashion, is that to you professional historians, the concept of our popular culture and its fascinations, these are as deliberately constructed as, for example, when we speak of sexuality and gender themselves, that they're not inherently natural in the world, that they really do get put together in the popular imagination.
And they get seen in certain ways. A case like this comes along, and there are many different ways that different societies could handle speaking about this case. But in the 1830s in America, certain features of it are more salient than others.
You're telling us that there was a time in our culture when we actually came to a sort of crossroads, a kind of turning point, when we would have been, it's hard to imagine American society without the effects of the popular culture that we live in.
Right.
And yet you are proposing, after a fashion, a kind of an alternative there, are you not?
I'm proposing that before the 19th century, a crime like this would have been not treated in this way at all. The sexual elements to it would have been very muted in any kind of description of the case. Whereas in this case, we had a newspaper editor who actually toured the brothel, described in loving detail the dead body on the floor, eroticizing and adding a charge to his description of what happened. To do that, he had to erase certain facts that were right in front of his eyes and not put them in his newspaper account. Namely, the body had already been autopsied and carved up by doctors, but that was never a part of his description.
Right.
So there's a way in which this case is being consciously used, or maybe unconsciously used, by newspaper editors to sell papers, to link sex and death, and to begin to establish categories that are now just really very familiar to us.
Is it fair to say, therefore, that we're looking really at the beginning of that bent in our American social character that leads us to things like the O.J. Simpson trial?
Yeah, I think so. This is a moment when a murder and a trial become highly publicized, where it's not just one version of the murder that gets out there, but multiple versions of the murder. It's a moment when lots of different people can get involved in discussing it, debating it, because there are juicy and meaty issues here. How guilty is a sexualized woman? How guilty is the guy who killed her? Did he really kill her? And so on. This is exactly the moment when this American culture is developing a receptivity to murder mysteries and so on. Poe is just on the horizon.
Right. And this is the guy who invented what we call the detective story.
Right, exactly. And his first detective story was a study of a murder case that happened in New York just 3 or 4 years after this, the Mary Rogers murder case that he turned into the story of Marie Roget.
On that note, Pat, is it fair to ask you at all about how instructive, what shall we call them, the lessons of history, when we look back at the Helen Jewett murder and try to understand all of these forces that come together in our own culture when we look at sensational murder stories in the press, for example?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I have an answer to it, actually. As an historian, I'm committed to the notion that studying history teaches us something. And so there must be something about this case beyond its intrinsic interest. It does have a lot of intrinsic interest. It's been fictionalized 5 times since 1836. It hasn't had a movie treatment yet.
But, I'm surprised.
Maybe that lies
ahead.
But I, as an historian, as a working historian, I'm committed to the notion that knowing the past helps inform us about the present. In this case, I would say that it is very useful to understand that the conjunction of eroticism and violence against women is a cultural construction of the 19th and 20th century. It's not something that has always been with us. It's something that we could, you know, perhaps do away with if we could massage the culture in different ways and change the constellation of events that made this popular and attractive at the time.
It doesn't seem like we're doing it in the 1990s, does it?
No.
even worse case scenarios, am I right?
Crimes become well known and popular because they do speak to important issues that cultures are worrying about. They identify and highlight nodes of or sites of contestation and problems.
Class and wealth and sexuality, issues like
right,
that.
Right, right.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Pat Cohen. Is it fair to say that at one level your book is a sort of media basher's manual here when we look at how Americans react to and understand sensational murder stories?
I resist that, actually. There is a way in which understanding how the media played a role in this crime is very important to my book, but I think really the central thread that I'm following in this book is the biography, mm-hmm. of a young girl who didn't live very long, left fairly small amount of written documentation. There is some by her. And so I don't intend to write a book that bashes the media, that and holds it responsible for the construction of this crime.
Are you essentially sympathetic to Helen Jewett herself, the victim in this murder case?
Yes, I think I'm very sympathetic to Helen Jewett. I'm trying to reconstruct her life as she saw it and see her life options. It's an extraordinary and unusual thing to be able to create this amount of documentation around the life choices of a young woman of her particular social class. Mm-hmm. For the most part, historians learn about prostitutes through the eyes of moral reformers who sweep in to a place, study the subjects of charity or the objects of derision and pity, and then write reports on it. And so it's highly unusual to have the words and voice of the participant in this culture herself to deal with. And that's been a very exciting part of this project, is the recovery of her own view of her worldview.
Patricia Klein Cohen is a professor of history at the University of California at Santa Barbara. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, she worked on a study of youth, murder, and sexuality in Jacksonian America. Patricia Klein Cohen is the author of A Calculating People, The Spread of Numeracy in Early America, available in paperback from the University of Chicago Press. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was Patricia Klein Cohen of the University of California at Santa Barbara. Cassette tapes of this discussion are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 786. That's $10, program number 786. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, Americans and the Sense of Evil. Literary scholar and social critic Andrew Del Banco of Columbia University will be here to talk about his new book, The Death of Satan. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.